This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We think there's already so much fraud in the carbon credits market that people aren't going to trust it if it's at the scale you're describing. Like, we want it to be a local community organization that understands the environmental, ecological needs of their local community, and they will trust that the bank is actually hoarding the carbon that it says it is.
Have you ever thought about how random it seems that gold is worth, well, its weight in gold? This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, Gustav Peebles, is an anthropologist and monetary policy expert at Stockholm University. He's not only wondered about the way human beings assign value to a particular element on the periodic table, he's pondered what it would look like if we applied precious valuation to an element that really matters for our own survival, like atmospheric carbon. In his new book, co-written with Benjamin Lozado, The First and Last Bank, Climate Change Currency, and a New Carbon Commons, Peebles lays out a novel, scalable way not to just dole out carbon credits, but to actually monetize the conservation of carbon waste. We discuss the fundamentals of a possible carbon banking system and talk through just how such a concept might roll out.
Who are these children who scheme and run wild? Who speak with their wings in the way that they smile? What are the secrets they trace in the sky? And why do you tremble each time they ride by? Throw out your gold teeth and see how they roll. The answer they reveal, life is unreal.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Gustav Peebles. He is an associate professor of anthropology at Stockholm University. Gustav, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
So you and your co-creator of this book, The First and Last Bank, Ben Lozado, why don't you first spell out the thesis of The First and Last Bank?
Sure, no problem. So the general thesis is that humanity has already beta tested the sequestration of an element from the periodic table in the form of the gold standard. Fairly quickly, humanity, in a sort of interestingly global and somewhat disorganized way, unintentionally sequestered a huge amount of the gold that was on the planet and put it into banks. So we said, oh, if the challenge today is to sequester carbon, could we sort of take some lessons from the era of the gold standard to figure it out how to do that at scale and relatively quickly? So we don't propose that it's a silver bullet or anything like that, but it does argue that there's tools in place already happening on the ground. There's no legislative needs here. Like, you don't need to wait for senators to agree to this plan. It's something that we can start immediately by following practices that are well established.
Is this a new twist on carbon sequestration?
Right. So it argues that we are leveraging the power of banking, right? So they would sequester carbon. And just like the gold standard, they would sequester the carbon that's closest to hand at first. And then gradually, if the communities that owned the banks so chose, they could figure out additional ways to sequester more carbon, which is exactly what happened with the gold standard in the 1800s and the 1900s. And so the idea is that banks are these interesting, and it's counterintuitive, but banks are decommodification machines. They choose a good out of a range of goods, and they force it into a hoard. That's what they do by nature. There's a reason why banks and temples have a long and interwoven history throughout many human cultures and across many different parts of the globe. They are really good at saying, this is the place where we've all decided to sequester our most valued objects.
Yes, and you write about how Fort Knox is kind of this combination of a bank and a temple. And it's a very odd concept if you think about it. It's a very expensive endeavor to hoard one's gold, like the way the United States has done with Fort Knox. And so it's in Kentucky, inland, so that no one can get their gold from the coast. And then it's built up into this impenetrable fortress with a very useless commodity in there, essentially, but it's been ascribed by our culture as having value. It's a very odd exercise if one steps away from it.
Correct. It's not like water, for example.
Right.
You don't need gold to survive every day. That's correct. And so that's what's so interesting. If you study the history of human hoarding practices, hoarding is something that all cultures do, and they are picking out a good from a range of goods and deeming it sacred and beyond negotiation, that everyone agrees that our future depends on this good. And that's why we're going to stash it away in a sacred and safe place, highly protected. And what's so interesting about Fort Knox is that in this, our era of political disagreement, that line item in the budget doesn't come up. You know, no one sits around saying, how can we offload this price to the governmental budget? No, there's a bipartisan consensus that we're going to keep paying for Fort Knox, and it doesn't come up as a big debate, which is quite interesting because there is a hungry market of gold purchasers out there waiting to buy that gold, but it's just not for sale. So the people who study the gold standard, they do call Fort Knox a decommodified reserve of gold. So the U.S. government has no intention of selling it, which means that it's been pulled off the market and made priceless. And that's what we think is so interesting and counterintuitive, that banks know how to move goods from being priced to priceless. And we think that you can follow the same trajectory with carbon to make it priceless.
I want to dive into that concept in a second, but I couldn't help but think while you were spelling out the ins and outs of Fort Knox in the book about this joke that Sarah Silverman, the comedian, tells about squirrels. They're always very nervous and nobody wants your acorns. You're obsessed with squirreling away your little acorns, but no one else eats acorns in the animal kingdom. You're okay. No one's going to steal them. But this random metal that we've decided has some kind of import has been our chosen source of wealth in some ways.
Yeah, in fact, and we cited in the book, Ben and I, that there was, during the era of the gold standard, there were economists who were making fun of, they were literally mocking, just like Sarah Silverman does, they were mocking the gold standard. They pointed out exactly as you do, you know, how strange is it that we dig into a natural vault called a mountain at great expense and great effort. We hack away at it, and then all we do is put it back into a new vault that we built, that nature had already provided us with the original vault. The gold was hard to get to. We hacked away at it, and now we've got an artificial vault that we move it back into. And then during the era of the gold standard, a lot of the time these crates of gold would just have to move from one vault to another across a national boundary. And it really just didn't make any sense. And so then the monetary policy people of that era started thinking about ways to liberate ourselves from the gold standard. But as Fort Knox attests, we haven't quite, it's no longer attached to the value of the dollar, but clearly we still deem it sacred in some way.
And we've covered the early stages of crypto on SeaChange Radio from over a decade ago. Some were looking at get-rich schemes, but I think in the beginning it was much more of a noble idea of ridding ourselves of these central banks which ascribe value to something, and it's just as random to create these bitcoins or whatever we want to decide is worth something. How does your concept differ from the blockchain concept?
Yeah, Ben and I are quite clear about this, or I hope we are in the book, that the cryptocurrency movement, if we want to call it that, has always been sort of quite proudly anti-bank. That they are actually frustrated, as you just said, with central banking power, and they would like to eliminate this, you know, what they deem to be a sort of silly intermediary in the exchange of money. Whereas, you know, banks can't currently serve as clearinghouses of exchange transactions, they've shown that you don't need that, right? You can just do it peer to peer. And what we think is that we are pro bank, because banks have proven throughout human history on many, many, many occasions that they're darn good at hoarding things. And we want that tactic right now to sequester carbon. We don't want to challenge it. We don't want to build anything new. We want to dig into something that is long proven and is a go-to technique for hoarding and sequestering, and that's banks. So that's why we are not in favor. This is a digital money project. It is not a cryptocurrency project. And the other thing that we try to clarify in the book is that, you know, one thing that banks can do, and again, like showing the interwoven history with temples, is banks are collective organizations for sharing capital. Now, you can be anti-bank, and there's all sorts of people who are, but banks don't need to be profit-driven throughout human history. They often are not. And so what we're saying is that we know that they have this special power, and we know that they can be collectively owned, but in a commons, they have in the past. And we think that they serve as this sort of temple to carbon in our argument, where people could come together and have a collective institution to practice this, you know, this work towards elevating carbon to a sacred good. And that's very different than what crypto does. Crypto is very individually oriented, right? It's not about joining a collectivity in the same way and doing daily work to make a collective institution function.
I've gone through two small fortunes, and I'm not happy yet. The first I spent to win your love, the last one to forget. One fortune bought you riches, and the other bought me wine. Now you're gone, you're with me.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Gustav Peebles. He is an associate professor of anthropology at Stockholm University. So, Gustav, we're talking about creating a carbon bank. Why don't you walk us through how logistically it could work in a country like Sweden? I think Sweden would be a better test case for the policies that you're setting forth here, because it's a much more progressive country where policy comes first and not politics in a lot of ways. And you don't have a big climate change denial movement in that country, for example. So let's say that Sweden decides to embrace your concept. Walk us through a few steps that they would need to take to see this become a reality.
Sure. Yeah. So thanks for that question. So basically, the key idea here is that it doesn't need to be all that prescriptive. I will go ahead and explain some ideas, but that we have. But the idea is that banking is already well established, and so groups of people could agree to set up a bank if they wanted to. And they could also, as has long been proven, rely on what's called the local currency movement, which is a well-established movement as well of like the ability to issue local money. So you wouldn't need the Swedish government to say, okay, well, now we're going to base the Swedish krona on this idea. So you could start your own local bank and not worry about convincing the Swedish central bank. With that said, you know, what Ben and I are so fixated on is saying that, look, a lot of this work is already happening out in the world, like by activists and experts all across the planet as we speak. And so we want to take that sort of path of least resistance and say, okay, who's already doing this work? So for example, in Sweden, we do already have what are called mission-driven banks in English, banks that have agreed in their charter to not set profit as the highest goal, but say, for example, the environment, or, you know, it could be any number of things. And then there's also in Europe, a longstanding tradition of gardening, local cooperative gardening spaces throughout their cities in Europe.
And the U.S. too.
Yeah, the U.S. has that as well. And they're already trusted institutions that are known to care for the environment, and they are known to be governed in a commons. Like, these people meet every week or every month to sort of govern their space. They set rules. They don't need the police state to like, or a police, I shouldn't say police state. They don't need the police to organize and determine their rules. They follow them as a group already. And so you could picture a mission-driven bank grafting its accounting skills onto a gardening cooperative that already exists. And then that would be the place where everyone in the neighborhood, not just the people who are already in the gardening cooperative, could come with their waste carbon to pyrolyze it, as we said, that's the term that they, so they would have a local pyrolyzer that would be no different than what in the during the gold standard, the banks had assaying devices for figuring out how much gold you were bringing to the bank. And so you could bring your carbon waste to that gardening collective. I think in America, it would be a different model. Ben and I have discussed. I can get into that if you're interested. But this is the, you asked about Sweden. So this is the, what we deem to be right now the path of least resistance that you could, and then in exchange for bringing your carbon waste, you would be depositing that in the bank and they would be giving you a local currency that could be used in the local community, just like a typical bank.
So how do you measure the purity of carbon and how would we physically be able to hoard it this way?
Right. So it turns out this fits into our argument as well that there's already work on the ground happening in this regard. And it's so organizations that are being built as we speak, such as the International Biochar Initiative, where they are figuring out how to measure the quality of carbon. And so you would, again, just like an assaying device in an old gold bank, you could have their measuring tactics and standards and verification techniques to figure out how much carbon is being brought into the bank.
And could there be a penalty for wasting this carbon once we've created this value? I'm thinking of carbon emissions, for example, that are just going into the atmosphere and won't be able to be hoarded or sequestered.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think right now, the way we're thinking about it, again, with the sort of path of least resistance argument, and maybe I should take a step back and say, like, one of the sort of starting points of our argument is that our governments have failed us here, and they are not delivering on the threat of climate change. So everything that we propose in the book does not rely on governments. And so when you say the word penalty, we could imagine one of those. But since we're sort of trying to think about positive incentives instead of negative incentives, it's harder to imagine that without a government. But if certainly if the government adapted this project, then there could be penalties for that. But I think it's more that this is going to start just like deposit banking started. I mean, this is something people don't understand about the banks that you and I use every day today. They started with philanthropic and volunteer labor in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s. They were loss-making organizations. They were in the red, and they relied on dedicated activists to encourage people to bank. So a very fascinating moment in human history to sort of encourage people to bring their gold and silver to the bank and become members of a deposit-granting institution. And that's sort of what we're picturing is sort of that kind of model.
When you're saying these 1820s, 1830s, these are the mission-driven banks, right?
They were originally mission-driven banks. Yeah, there's still mission-driven banks around today, but yes, the original mission-driven banks were, they were even called Sunday banks, and it was often just a church deacon who was, collecting the, excess cash that his flock had in the nearby area, and then he was assembling it in a lockbox, and then gradually that banking system grew. Not least because philanthropists like contributed to the flourishing of the bank so that it wouldn't go under as a technique for convincing people to start banking, right? Instead of, as they say, proverbially keeping it in the mattress. It's a tactic that we haven't really turned to with the threat of climate change and the need to sequester carbon. So, for example, the European Union, has a long history of saying, how do we solve the problem of too much butter? And they then, and right now we have the problem of too much carbon in the sky. So, the European Union knew how to build a mountain of butter. There were problems with it. They no longer do it, but they did do it. And so I think that's similar to what you're talking about. Now, the deposit banking movement that we're talking about did set the stage for the general everyday deposit banking that you and I have today that is then, of course, affiliated with the bond sales that you're talking about later, but they're not, they don't graft onto one another perfectly. But the person who was credited with starting this deposit banking movement, he was a deacon in Scotland named Duncan, And he supposedly spent £100 a year on postage because everyone around the planet was interested in his movement, and he had to correspond with them.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Gustav Peebles. He's an associate professor of anthropology at Stockholm University. So you're talking about creating these positive reinforcing policies to create this carbon bank. I know Sweden was at the forefront of gamification when it comes to things like speeding tolls. I don't know if you're familiar with this system that Sweden put in around 10 years ago, where instead of having a penalty for speeding, you know, if you exceed 50 kilometers per hour in this zone, you get a ticket. Instead of that, if your license plate gets registered as being under 50 kilometers per hour in this zone, you get entered into a lottery and you can eventually win. And they saw much better results in terms of the average speed in this area because people had a positive incentive rather than fear. They were hopeful. Did you incorporate any of this kind of gamification theory into your idea? It sounds fairly similar in some ways.
I love that story. That's great. Thank you for that. We don't have a whole list of ideas for gamification, but we do have a leap of faith in the book that there are loads and loads and loads of people who are ready to figure out if they're given a pathway to contribute to the fight against climate change, they will seize it. The problem right now is that we all sort of feel like, well, we're waiting for our governments to solve it, or maybe a corporation like Google will figure out how to suck the carbon out of the air, and then I don't have to worry about it anymore. If you're going to take the sovereignty back that's been abandoned by our governments, there will take some work, but it'll be fun work. It'll be a community organization that you will become committed to.
And at its core, you see this much more of a grassroots concept than being able to, from the get-go, implement these carbon banks on a mass scale for governments and corporations to participate in. You see it more being people first. Is that an accurate characterization?
Yes, that's absolutely accurate. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Because you are totally right. An economist who read the book long ago said, oh, this is a great idea. Why don't you just get the Fed to do it? You know, and the problem is the Fed doesn't take these kinds of risks, right? They only take these kinds of risks once they are pressured to take these kinds of risks by outside actors. So the Fed, so one of the sentences in the book is something along the lines of, you know, in the financial crisis, the Fed agreed to hoard, to sequester toxic assets that were largely valueless, right, in order to save the financial system. So we say, well, if the Fed's willing to sequester toxic assets, during a financial crisis to solve a financial crisis, why can't they sequester toxic assets in order to stop a climate crisis? We're not sitting around and waiting for that to happen. And instead, we think we should build grassroots banks that if they do take off and they do show that they're working models, then the Fed might start paying attention. But we don't want to worry about that for now. We don't want to spend time lobbying. We think people are ready to jump in and do this as we speak. And the second reason that we're grassroots focused is because we think there's already so much fraud in the carbon credits market that people aren't going to trust it if it's at the scale you're describing. Like, we want it to be a local community organization that understands the environmental ecological needs of their local community, and they will trust that the bank is actually hoarding the carbon that it says it is.
Yes, and how do you try to avoid a similar problem with carbon offsets where companies can just kind of pay their way out of the problem, but the problem doesn't go away just because you pay for it. The carbon emissions keep getting emitted. We're fining corporations for doing that in that carbon offset scenario. But in yours, how do you see that maybe evolving to incorporate emissions? That seems to be the holy grail of getting to where you need to get to for this to really take off beyond the grassroots level.
Right. Yes, I agree. So we do talk about there's two important things there. So first of all, the community banks that are grassroots originally will be assembling capital as they get going, right? I mean, that's the whole idea, that the carbon reserve that they're hoarding will be, you know, you could leverage it, as we say, to take environmentally sound investments. So they could be themselves pushing forward the climate transition with new capital that is currently too scarce. So that's one thing that they could be doing to help stop the emissions that you're talking about. But secondly, and very importantly, what's so interesting about the digital money revolution is that in order to have a bank account for digital money as opposed to cash, you actually have to be approved by the bank. And so you have to have an account at the bank in order to receive digital money, whereas cash you can pass around and not have an account, right? So what we can do, we believe, is that our banks can set standards for giant customers, like let's just say some agricultural company wants to receive, if they want to receive our coin, our digital money from our depositors, then they have to build an account. And in order, just like the U.S. government enforces the Know Your Customer system across the globe today that sets standards for, you know, to make sure there's no terrorist financing, for example, our banks could set standards and say, sorry, we know you're a polluter. We're not giving you a bank account here. If you want access to our depositors, you have to show us that you're not a polluter. Like one of the things that we like about the idea of local banks is that right now, you know, if somebody wants to work on Wall Street, they often have to be specialists in finance. But our banks would need specialists in ecology, for example, like soil scientists as well. Because the question, as you say, is where do they put this carbon reserve, right? There, it's going to grow. It's going to be big if everything's working out. And they would of course, have vaults, and there's ways in which the banks could be networked so that the banks in the rural districts could hold the money, the carbon reserve of a bank in an urban neighborhood. But there's other ways, a very important tactic used during the gold standard of so-called sterilization of the reserves, so that you can actually sequester carbon that you don't want to monetize following an age-old tactic of banking. So there's all sorts of ways. And then that carbon could then go be used as fertilizer in fields or water, you know, purification units, all sorts of things that it can end up in concrete and buildings now.
It could help build another Fort Knox.
There you go.
The book is entitled The First and Last Bank, and it comes out June 17th. Gustav Peebles, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much. Good time.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Steely Dan, Johnny Paycheck, and Van Morrison.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.